Look kindly on our world, O God, as we suffer and struggle with one another. Look kindly upon your church, driven by the same necessity, and may the light we have seen in Jesus illuminate and brighten all the world. Lord, let us be at peace within ourselves. Let us accept that we are profoundly loved and need never be afraid. Let us be aware of the source of being that is common to us all and to all living creatures. Holy God, you created all peoples in your image. We thank you for the wonderful diversity of races and cultures in this world. Enrich our lives by ever-widening circles of friendship. Show us your presence in those who most differ from us. So our knowledge of your love made perfect in our love for all your children. Lord, make us instruments of your peace. Where there's hatred, there's still love. Where there's injury, pardon. Where there's discord, union. Where there's doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. Grant that we may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in the giving that we receive, it is in parting that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. So we're continuing on our series on the I Am theme in the book of John. We've gone through I Am the Bread of Life, I Am the Light of the World. I kind of skipped ahead to Resurrection and the Life, and now we're coming back to I Am the Sheep Gate. Next week we'll be hearing about I Am the Shepherd. And it's kind of interesting because that's the word we're getting, so that we don't overlap too much in our messages, because the metaphors are mixed in this passage. But I think we can learn at the imagery of some of these words. So today we are looking at Jesus and saying, I am Jesus. And finally, we turn in these titles. Jesus gives salvation in life. And when I thought about the image of gateway, I thought about actually probably one of the more common things that we see, which is the border between Canada and the U.S. And how many here have actually crossed that border by car? Okay, great. And I assume that most of you have crossed some kind of border, like national border before. So Canada and the U.S. have the longest international boundary in the world, shared by two nations. So it's generally a pretty friendly border. Unless you meet a disgruntled security officer or customs official. And it's friendly unless you're trying to do something illegal. So, but if you have all your documentation in place, there should be no reason why you can't cross into the state or Quebec. It just might take some time. And you could have known if you're driving down to the state. The wait time being anywhere from 20 minutes to 6 hours. It's a long wait. And by the time you make it to the security point, you have to be careful. Not to be either too excited that you're making there, or else you'll arouse some suspicion. Or you can't be too irritable or aggravated and or otherwise will also aggravate the security guard or the border officials. All I have to say is that it's very something that happens. So while we can question whether or not we can treat a security as a border, we don't often question why those securities might exist. Borders are a clear boundary marker between two nations. The boundary that opens up in this case, where 300,000 people cross every day between Canada and the U.S. The border exists to protect a nation's interests, to control trade, and to provide security for its citizens. The border exists to keep unwanted people out and to protect the resources that are within. And in order to do that, especially on our border, there has to be a control point of entry or checkpoint. People don't just randomly cross wherever they want at any given point. You have to cross at a certain point, otherwise you're illegal to do so. And we see this happening in a disputed area where, and there are parts of Canada, where there's dispute, where the line isn't clear, and Canada and the U.S. have been arguing where the line is. And I recently listened to a story of a Tsuwakan First Nation fisherman who was arrested for fishing in American waters. For Stephen Stark, the waters he fished in were part of Tsuwakan First Nation territory, traditional territory. And for him, and the Tsuwakan First Nation, the border between Canada and the U.S. was imposed on him and his people. He don't exist, basically. The lines we don't see, especially the girl in the water. But it's a line that the two nations are legal, or they have the power to uphold. So boundaries. We live with our lives with multiple boundaries. Spaces that are marked off by lines and walls, sometimes visible, sometimes invisible. Physical boundaries are easy to point out. There are these walls that bound us from the outside, to the outside out and the inside in. Sidewalks help us to indicate where we can walk safely and where cars go down. Neighborhoods identify location, but also sometimes socioeconomic class and racial status. There are social boundaries, lines that are drawn around groups of people that dictate behavior that is acceptable and what is not. There are boundaries that are close out of the space between you and I. I exist here, you exist there. But is the actual boundary, or the actual distance between us, greater or smaller than we see? Well, the man that Jesus healed in our reading today knew about boundaries. He encountered boundaries right from birth, for he was born blind. All he has known is darkness, while others told him there is light. There is something that he was missing. He could hear and speak with his parents. He could know them by the touch of their faces, the roughness of his father's beard, or the wrinkles around his mother's eyes while she laughed. But later, I'm sure as he was an adult, he would only know them by their voices or the tread of their steps. He could smell bread and hear the animals make noise in the marketplace. And you can never see colorful scars or the hanging on the leaf hanging on the skulls. You can smell incense, the candles burning in the temple. song of songs being sung, or the call to the legislators. And he would never before height or breadth was heard of the temple. He would never see the gold that dazzled the worshiper, or the brightness of the torches that lit up on every side. Maybe he had friends telling him, "Oh, I wish you could see the crowd, or how high that tower is, or how beautiful that girl is, or I wish you could see where you're going, because you're going to hurt someone." I never thought of that moment when this individual first realized there was something wrong with him, that being blind was a disadvantage. Side of God's favor. That moment in a child's life when others tell them that they don't belong, they don't deserve normal treatment, that they are on the outside while others belong in. That man, his blindness was a boundary he could never cross. And he knew where he could and couldn't go. His blindness marks him off from fighting people, particularly those fighting people who go in and out of the temple as they wish or receive. Those fighting people who could earn money by working. Those fighting people who constantly wondered if he was blind because God cursed him, or since he or his family had been. Could you imagine his predicament, his lost life, forever excluded, forever blind? And then imagine the moment when you hear or when you heard the word that Jesus said. Neither this man nor his parents did. He was born blind so that God's word might be revealed to him. We must work. The works of him is steady while it is day. Night is coming when no one is born. As long as I am the world, I am the light of the world. Jesus went to the man, made a paste of mud and saliva, and spread it on the man's eyes, and told him to wash in the pool of Siloam, which meant sent. Scholars wonder if this has a connection to the prophetic words of Isaiah, when he was warning the people of God of the Assyrian invasion. This is from Isaiah chapter 8, starting at verse 5. The Lord spoke to me again, because the people have rejected the gently flowing waters of Siloam, or Shiloh, and rejoices over Rezin and the son of Ramallah. Therefore the Lord is about to bring against them the mighty floodwaters of the Euphrates, the king of Assyria, with all their armies. So one can say that the people of Jesus' time were about to reject the living waters sent by God. Right from the beginning of John's Gospel, John tells his readers that light entered into the world, but they could not understand or recognize it. Perhaps the pool of Set, the pool of Siloam, was an image reminding readers that Jesus could not be recognized, even though a great miracle was about to happen. And the man goes and does what Jesus told him to do, and he receives Christ for the first time. Can you imagine dealing with a whole new set of sensory information all at once? It would be like plucking a rural farmer from the 1600s and dropping him into 20th century New York. It would be totally dazzling and overwhelming. We don't know how much time he had to process all that he was seeing. But according to the story, soon after, he was immediately called into question. say, yes, I do. I'm not mad before blind. And now I see. And the next question that people have is like, well, who did this? Where is it? And I'll maybe reading into the text, but there seems to be no indication of celebration, awe, or praise. That's such a moral criticism. He can't be healed. He can't be doing that man. So they took him to the Pharisees to be judged. Maybe, finally, one of the folks, this man could be counted a whole, as healed, as one of the sighted ones, acceptable and obedient to God. But there was a glitch. This all happened on the Sabbath day. And this law apparently was broken by the healer, this man called Jesus. Therefore, because he broke the law, Jesus cannot be from God. And so too, the healing, therefore, is not God. And if you read through chapter 9, you see there's question after question. They ask this man for his own opinion, and that wasn't enough. So his parents were brought in, that out of fear, they claim no knowledge of what happened. So then the man was brought forth again with the Pharisees. Basically, we see another trial after this. And in the fascinating exchange between the powerful and the powerless, the man testified to Jesus' work as being of God. That his healing was a blessing. And if Jesus was not of God, then he would not be able to do anything. Likely a slight jab against the Pharisees, who obviously could heal the man. They probably didn't even try. When the man resisted their accusations, they responded with the one power they knew how to wield. They casted him out. They pulled the ego card, very sinner from birth, and they exercised him like he was a demon. So here we have a man who was punished for his blindness. And now he's being punished for having sight. Jesus heard what happened. And he thought about it. I wonder if the man recognized Jesus at first. Perhaps his voice gave away. In their conversation, Jesus once again brought sight to the man by revealing to him the Son of Man. A curious title, one that still puzzles people. And yet, by this name, the man knelt in worship. The Pharisees are still in the picture. They saw this conversation happening, and they challenged Jesus. Jesus told them bluntly that they are guilty for their blindness. For they claim to see, but they fail to see the one who are, and the one who is not. And so it's against this story that we receive two more I am things. I am the sheep gate, and I am the shepherd. So my question is, why does Jesus refer to himself as the sheep gate? Now, the image of God as shepherd, as we've read in Psalm 23, I think it was likely a very familiar image for the early church, or for the early hearers. Not to see how the people of Israel were like sheep. We're not intelligent, prone to wander, and needed someone to guide and protect them from that dependence. There seems to be a couple major elements to preparing for sheep. The first is to find adequate pastures for food and water. The second is to guard them at night while they slept. The shepherd leads his flock out by day by nourishment, and he will bring them in into an enclosure to guard by night. There's some belief that shepherds would have laid across the one opening that this enclosure would have, acting as a human gate. So we don't know if this image, or we don't know if this is the image that they would have had when they heard I am a sheep gate. I think the point is more that there's only one opening, there is only one gate, there's only one door. The sheep gate is the only point of entry and exit for the fold. In order for them to find protection from evil, they must go through the gate. In order for them to find life, food, and drink, they must go out through the gate. All other ways, like how the thieves and robbers work, do not bring life. Instead, it brings destruction. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. The gate is unique. The gate is vital. Jesus is the gate that saves and brings life. This is in stark contrast to the Pharisees, who were fixated on the law that Moses gave. They had the light of the Torah, but couldn't accept Jesus as light of the world. Jesus was not shy in comparing the thieves and robbers to the Pharisees and cast it at the man out. Jesus said that the one who enters through the gate is the rightful shepherd. All others are thieves. And Jesus leads his sheep with care and nourishes them, heals them, seeks them out. Whereas the Pharisees, who is their child, insults them and casts them. They have failed to care for the man who fell to the blind, and they failed to care for the man after the season. They have failed in the role of caregivers of God's law. In studying this passage, I've been reminded how Jesus continues to stand on the border, that through him we find salvation and life. I read in Greco-Roman culture, society was highly stratified. There were only a few that were really, really wealthy, and the rest of the common folk were typically workers and poor. So a system was set in place between those who had resources and those who didn't. But they still need those same resources. Scholars identify this relationship as patron-client relationship. It is an unequal relationship between parties of different statuses. A client may receive goods from a patron, but they accumulate debt and obligation to the patron. In these relationships, often have favoritism, issues of honor, and also faithfulness of the client involved. Human patron client relationship serves as a model for God's human relationship. Without getting into too much detail, it suffices to say that God is viewed as the patron, and his clients were humans. A God being God was inaccessible to humans. So a mediator is needed. A mediator stands on the border. They are the bridge. They are the go-between. They are the grocer. God's favor. For the ancient Israelites, that broker was Moses. But for John, the broker is Jesus. He is the gate of salvation. He is the gate of life. So what makes Jesus a broker? What makes him a successful broker? Well, one is that he belongs to both sides. He belongs to both the world of the patron and of the client. So that of the divine and the human. Only Jesus is able to be in relationship with both at the same time and continuously. Only Jesus holds the best interests of the Father and of the sheep at the same time. We will see it as we read through John's Gospel, how Jesus is the only unique way to the Father. So now, what can we as the people of God take away from this passage? That Jesus is our gate to salvation, our deadly forces, and our gate to nourishment and life. Well, I see a couple of challenges. The first challenge is that it's hard to remember that there is no other way other than through Jesus. But there is another way of salvation and life is better. The belief that held so strongly today is that we can be our own salvation. We can find life apart from God. That we can find our own freedom and justice. But I don't quite buy it. Christ shows us a different way of being. That at the end of the day, it's not about how productive, successful, or history-making that I've been, but it is going to be about Christ. Life, death, a direction, and ascension. Trust his life changes mine, his life changes yours. The second challenge I see is that my belief in Christ also is shaped by my experience of God. Like the blind man, I worship Christ because I once was blind, but now I see. I have been brought to life and preserved from glory. However, if I have trouble experiencing healing, or if I have felt quite unprotected, and abandoned, then I'm going to doubt God's wisdom. A lot of bad things can happen to great people, to vulnerable people. And there are still things that come to steal, kill, and destroy. And so, the sheep will gather. The challenge then to maintain hope and trust when we don't believe that healing is there. How is it possible? To me, that's just how in looking at what makes Jesus the broker between us and God. It is his loyalty and faithfulness to the Father, and it is care and love for us. I trust Jesus because I see his care for people, particularly those who are disadvantaged. No one went to care for the blind man. I've been reminded in the past couple of days that the mark of a good disciple, a good follower of the way. Not how well they shine for Jesus, or how earnest their intentions are, or how well they can tell a story, but how well they can love. Jesus' care for people continues to be the main reason why I follow him. And so we need to ask ourselves as a church, if Jesus is the one who mediates God's love to us, who stands in the gap between us and the Father, then what stands between you and I and with each other? Do we allow things to stand in the way, like border security? Or do we allow Christ to mediate as a bridge? Do we as a church stand in the way between those who don't see God? Or do we come like Christ as bridge builders and peacekeepers? Do we care? Do we care about people? Do we care about one another? I've been having a hard time trying to know how to end the sermon and where to land. Because on the one hand, I see the ways that we do shine, the ways that we are being mediators of God's love. But then, we also face the challenge of how the church is viewed by society. The truth is, the church has lost a lot of credibility in the eyes of the public. And in some spaces, we have trouble speaking or being heard because people don't want to listen to us anymore. So, I want to leave a question to you. Think about is the church generally viewed as caring or uncaring? I know it's a very broad question. In your interactions with friends, do you generally have a positive view of the church? Or do they feel apathetic towards the church? Who here thinks the church has a positive? I've heard like people view the church positively. And I'm not about to talk about like RSC, but just overall. Positive? Negative? Justin Bedell. faith are a lot of influence in society. Adult people, just be able to shape a lot of policies. So that's been weighing, and I think the church kind of struggles with that. We can't just speak, and everybody listens. But I wonder why. Why is that? Any guesses?